Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation. Welcome back, listeners. Thanks for joining me again. Today on Military Justice, we're returning to the Bo Bergdahl case. I have a guest on today, Colby Vokey. He's a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel, lawyer, currently does criminal defense work in the civilian sector, and he's also been closely working with the serial team and Mark Bohl. So he's got a lot of insights about the Bergdahl case, specifically the interaction with the Bergdahl case and the second season of Serial. Today, Colby and I will be discussing both the request by the Army to try to get the other unaired portions of the Mark Bohl, Bo Bergdahl interviews, and we will also be discussing the pardon request that Bergdahl's lawyers forwarded to the president. Without any further delay, thank you very much for joining us, and here's my interview with Colby Vokey. Thank you. Today we're joined by Colby Vokey, a criminal defense attorney out of Dallas who's had years and years of experience in the military as a judge advocate, and probably the highlight of his career was the time he served as my boss for a number of years at Camp Pendleton. Is that correct?
Oh, without a doubt, that's the highlight.
Well, thank you for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And we'll have all your contact information up on the show notes. But first, I'd like to ask you, how did you get involved in the Bergdahl case?
As I think most people know, when Bergdahl came back, it created quite a stir. And there was a journalist out there named Mark Bohl who reached out to Bergdahl and interviewed him. He interviewed him for about 25 hours. And Mark Bohl is a journalist. He's been embedded with the military a number of times. And in addition to, he's written a number of articles. He wrote an article that led to the movie called In the Valley of Eli. He's written a lot of different articles. He covered the kill team cases up at Fort Lewis, Washington.
Oh, right. The Army Striker cases?
That's right. And then he also wrote and produced a couple of movies, The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. Won a couple Academy Awards for The Hurt Locker.
Those are pretty huge movies, yeah. So he's really got his tentacles into a lot of different things.
He does, he does. A fantastic guy. One of my favorite clients I've ever represented in my life. Just love the guy.
Oh, great.
Well, he interviewed Bergdahl, and then with those tapes, he took it to the Serial podcast, which I think, as everybody knows, is the number one listened to podcast in the country. And
this podcast will soon take it over. I only need about 190 million downloads, and then I got him.
Well, he took it to the Serial podcast people, and they decided to do their second season of Serial on the Bergdahl story. So they did the first episode, which includes recordings from Bohl's interview of Bo Bergdahl. So it was after that that I became involved. I understand when the Army came back and there was quite a bit of a stir, and the Serial podcast kind of covers kind of how we got there, but they had charged Bergdahl, and they had taken to an Article 32 investigation, you know, the military's sort of version of a grand jury. And they were waiting on the decision to refer him to an actual court-martial and to try him. It was during that period of waiting is when the first episode of the podcast with Bergdahl aired, and it got quite a bit of attention. Soon after that, the charges for Bergdahl were referred to a court-martial. And so there's quite a bit of talk at the time. There were some people actually blaming the Serial podcast for the Army's decision to refer Bergdahl, which is sort of ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. But, that's probably – I had heard a lot of that, and I've had questions about that, or, you know, from listeners that did the Serial podcast somehow prompt the Army? And I think we agree that that's very unlikely.
No, there's no way. I think the Army was going that course anyway for a variety of other reasons. But it was after that first podcast aired and all that attention came that they hired me as a consultant for the podcast to advise them on certain things.
So you worked with the Podmothers, Sarah Koenig and Julie Snyder?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Great. Great people, aren't they?
Absolutely fantastic. Sarah Koenig's an amazing woman. You want to talk about someone who has the ability to tell a story. She is fantastic.
Yeah, she really does. I ran into her at purposefully ran into her at a talk she was giving up here at Davis in California, and talked to her for probably an hour and a half after the talk, and she was just really riveting. She's an impressive person.
She really is. And yeah, I mean, you combine the two great storytellers, Mark Bull and Sarah Koenig, and you know you're going to have one fantastic product as a result. So they do the podcast. One of my concerns was in the very first episode before I got hired on to help out, they had disclosed in there that Mark Bull had interviewed Bo Bergdahl for 25 hours, and that was on the air. So as soon as I got hired and I listened to the first episode, I kind of cringed because I said, that's not a good thing to put on the air. The reason why is because you're kind of advertising the amount of material there. You're kind of sending a message to the prosecutor. Hey, look, we have all this material, but you know, nobody's going to hear it. So one of my concerns at the time was they may try to reach out and subpoena all the outtakes of those tapes.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you here, because I've been asked the same question. Was Bergdahl represented by counsel at the time Bowl talked to him? Do you know? I've never asked personally, but I think as we've both served a number of times as defense attorneys, it just seems so antithetical to have your client talking that long. You know, you want them to say nothing.
No, when Mark Bull first talked to Bo Bergdahl, Bergdahl did not have counsel at the time. Okay. He had not retained Gene Fidel at the time. So the podcast aired and it went through, I think we finished in January of 2016. And shortly after that, Mark Bull got contacted by the prosecutors for the Bergdahl court-martial, saying that they intended to subpoena all the tapes that he had taken with Bergdahl. So that's when my representation changes a little bit. So I start working on this. Now it's a First Amendment case. And we're dealing with a First Amendment reporter's privilege, which is something that hasn't touched the military very much ever in its history. So,
and you filed that in July of 16, right?
That's when we filed the suit, right?
Okay. And I'll make
this
sure the
started in March. There was a lot of talks and basically trying to keep them from issuing the subpoena. I was working also with a couple of First Amendment firms too in trying to kind of head this off at the pass and stop the subpoena from being issued.
Oh, so you're talking to trial counsel in the Bergdahl case, trying to obviate the need for this?
Yes. And working with the First Amendment lawyers first, we were working with the firm of Arnold and Porter out in Washington, D.C., just a fantastic firm with some really fantastic people. And then the person I've been working with directly on Mark Bull's case is a lawyer named J.P. Jassy, who's out of Los Angeles, does First Amendment work, a very talented lawyer, really knows his stuff. So it's actually been a lot of fun doing a First Amendment case, because it's just something that you don't get to do very often if you're in this line of work. So
right, and I'll make sure I put that pleading up on the Military Justice Twitter.
On July 20th, we filed our complaint for injunctive relief there in the Central District of California, the Western Division, basically L.A., to prohibit the military from issuing that subpoena. The day after, we filed a proposed temporary restraining order along the same lines. So that's what started the current kind of federal court litigation.
Where are you in that litigation now?
Well, we went through, we had a hearing in September, hearing with Judge George King, and that was on the application for the temporary restraining order. After that hearing, both sides got to present arguments, and they sent us to settlement conference, and that's currently where the thing still is.
Oh.
And the judge has not issued an order yet, and that's where it is right now.
And I think that people don't really have a feel for how long, you know, we can go back to the Haditha and Hammondia cases. Of course, you know, we've both been involved in Gitmo litigation. And then this case, with all its classified discovery and these type of side federal issues, federal case issues, that how long these cases take. Can you give a little
they
idea?
Do.
Yeah, I think that.
Well, and probably the easiest way to explain it is to talk a little bit about Haditha and Staff Sergeant Woodridge's case. And Staff Sergeant Woodridge was my client. So this case with Bergdahl involves the reporter's privilege, the First Amendment reporter's privilege of a reporter who gathers material and his right to be free from government interference. You know, it's the right of a reporter to report things, an incredibly important privilege. And the question is, does it apply to the military?
And so in the Woodridge case, so they were accused of a number of murders in Haditha, Iraq, in what, 04?
That's right.
Yeah, 05.
That's right.
And so he did an interview. Your client, Sergeant Woodrick, did an interview with 60 Minutes. Is that correct?
That's right. He sat down with Scott Pelley and did a big, long interview with 60 Minutes. Not my idea. I will say that. But he did this big interview with 60 Minutes. And then while the case was still ongoing, before we got into trial, 60 Minutes airs the show.
Right.
And so what happens is, as we're about ready to get to trial in early 2008, Woodridge and I were actually in Haditha, Iraq at the time, when co-counsel Haytham Faraj and Neil Puckett were arguing back in Camp Pendleton this whole issue. And the government there had tried to subpoena all the outtakes from CBS, from 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes came in with a motion to quash the subpoena at the court-martial. The military judge granted that motion to quash the subpoena, and the government appealed. So the appeal goes up to the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals, and there was some of it that actually went up to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. But a lot of it was on various different issues of whether the prosecutors can appeal this, and so there were a lot of different legal issues that were connected with it.
Yeah, I was actually at appellate government at the time for the Navy and Marine Corps, and at least my advice had been don't do this. It's going to stop your trial forever, at least 18 months to 2 years to do that.
Yes, absolutely. So in Woodridge, the case was stayed pending the appeal. I was lieutenant colonel at the time with Woodridge. Haytham Faraj was a major. He was my senior defense counsel and my co-counsel, and we were both due to retire. So we were supposed to try the case, and we were supposed to walk out the door in the spring of 2008. That didn't happen. So we had to delay our retirements because of this delay, the stay of the case. It got to the point where Haytham could not delay any longer. He had to go ahead and retire. I was in kind of a bad situation at the time, too, because my family had already moved back to Dallas on the retirement move. So I was living in a trailer by the lake on the base, just waiting to be there for Staff Sergeant Woodridge, when at one point, very abruptly, some folks from the Marine Corps told me, you can't stay anymore, you're going, you're retiring, and I had to leave. So both Haytham and I would end up going back and representing Staff Sergeant Woodridge's civilian counsel, because we weren't going to abandon him at that point. But the case didn't try for several years.
Yeah, I think it went in 12 eventually.
So many delays.
Did it finally?
That's right. Yeah, charges were preferred in the end of 2006, and it didn't actually go to trial until 2012, which is just amazing.
Yeah, so you have the incident happens in 2005. The spring and summer of 2006, I remember we were talking about it because you had when you were the regional defense counsel, and it doesn't end up going for another 6 years. So I think that people tend to think that the Bergdahl case, well, we know everything that happened, so this case is going to go. But it's not uncommon. I mean, these are uncommon cases. You know, they're not our normal DUIs or easy cases like that. But these cases take a long time.
They do. And Bergdahl's case, even more so, there's a lot of complications in that one. Now, I'm not involved in the intimate litigation there, but I've been trying to stay abreast of it and aware of it. They have so many issues in Bergdahl, and just the sheer amount of discovery and the amount of classified information that could possibly be part of it. It's already delayed it months and months and months. I think the latest is they've delayed Bergdahl's case until May, and my guess is it won't go until at least late summer. If then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we both know that from Gitmo, that when you have that classified discovery, when I was a prosecutor in Gitmo, we would ask for delays in 6 months chunks because it's just so it's so voluminous and it's so hard to work through. And we have a lot of other things going on in the Bergdahl case, including now with President Trump. That's going to add another layer of complexity, right?
Yeah, and a whole new level of unlawful command influence motions and all kinds of things. So, yes, I think that one's yes.
And
it's going to take a while. The Army would be well advised to get rid of that case, I'll tell you that.
And we have another cabinet member, Lieutenant General Flynn. He talks in the serial case about, you know, he's positive that people died looking for Bergdahl, but I don't know that that's the type of opinion that would hold up in court or hold up under scrutiny.
No, I don't think so either. So just because he's a general doesn't mean he knows what the hell he's talking about.
So this is another area, and don't be surprised if I'm knocking on your door again to ask you to come on to explain this, but you've been doing a lot of work on clemency petitions for war crimes, and can you tell us just a little bit about that?
I have. What we did is we are looking at, we've got seven soldiers that we are looking at to get either presidential clemency or pardons. So two of the applications are pardons. The rest of them are clemency to reduce their sentence or you know, let them out of jail or something along those lines. And that process is, it's like a whole new world when you enter the presidential pardon world.
Yeah. What are the mechanics of that?
There are certain forms that you got to fill out for each one. The clemency and the pardons are separate. It depends on your source of your conviction, too. If it is a military case, then the pardon and clemency applications are supposed to go through the Secretary of the Army first.
Okay.
And then from there, they go up to the Office of the Pardon Attorney. Now, the Office of the Pardon Attorney, you would think of as this is, you know, the president's person to say, here's who we should pardon. But it's actually not quite like that. It's more of another level of bureaucracy because
– And that's within DOJ?
It's within DOJ. Yeah. So DOJ kind of controls that. But all these mechanisms are placed. Sometimes the president may not even become aware of certain pardons are sitting up there. So it's been a struggle doing this because we're not even remotely confident that the president is even aware of any of the seven petitions that we put forth. Which is kind of discerning. So it's kind of a difficult process. Now, there's also a lot of different requirements for submitting these applications and certain prerequisites, too. For example, the two pardons that we submitted, two soldiers, one of them Michael Williams, the other one Corey Claggett, they'd already been released from Leavenworth. I got both of them released on pardon. I'm sorry, not through pardon, got them out on probation. So I got them released from Leavenworth. And then we submitted the pardon applications. But there are some guidelines that DOJ comes down for pardons. And one of the rules is that you're supposed to be released for 5 years before you can submit a pardon, which normally makes sense because if you're looking at somebody who is, say, a drug dealer,
right.
You don't want to grant a pardon for him 6 months after he's released because you want to make sure that the guy's on the straight and narrow.
Right.
So we asked for exceptions to that five-year policy because, frankly, the chance of recidivism for guys committed of war crimes is, well, zero.
Right. It's not like you're. It's not like you go back and they send you back to Afghanistan.
That's right. I mean, these guys are out of the army, and, right. and you know, these crimes are committed are so unique and so based on the circumstances, and you don't need to wait the 5 years. So we asked for an exception to that. Now, like in those cases, the Office of the Pardon Attorney came back with a letter to us saying that they haven't met the 5 year requirement, so they're not being considered. So now we've got to do something to get those pardon applications in front of President Obama. So you try all kinds of, there's all different ways. I mean, we've sent direct correspondence to the White House. It's through contact of various different officials, senators, congressmen, trying to get somebody in there to be an advocate and sit down with the president and say, just take a look at these. So it's a unique process, kind of a very political process. But we did it as part of a group. The University of Chicago Law School, they have a professor there named Mark Hireman. And Mark Hireman normally runs a mental health clinic. Well, for one semester last year, he changed that mental health clinic to a combat pardon program clinic. So he had students that were assigned these each one of the cases. They actually got to travel and meet these guys, go to Leavenworth and meet them, and working with the attorneys to develop these pardon applications. So it was through the University of Chicago's law school. So he had a number of different people working on it and trying to get this to the attention of the president. So it's been an interesting program and a project. We're just hoping to get relief for some of them. Now, the relief we're asking, it varies by each one of these applicants that we have. I mentioned Williams and Claggett. Those are the pardon applications. We've got another soldier named Derek Miller, who was convicted for the death of a detainee that was happening during interrogation. That's one of the cases that kind of breaks my heart the most. Derek Miller is such a fantastic guy, and he's the kind of guy who absolutely does not belong in jail. But he would not plead guilty. He fought his case, was found guilty, and got the, because he was charged with premeditated murder, got the mandatory minimum life. So he's a guy that we're trying to get out. And that one's really a shame. I read the record of trial on that, and you get right up to, I mean, I already know the conclusion, but you're reading it and you're like, how could anybody find this guy guilty? You got to be kidding me. But they did, and that's what happened. We also have, of that group, Sergeant Bales. He was the Army soldier who everybody probably remembers, if they don't remember his name, is kind of went a little crazy and went into a village and killed about 16 people out in Afghanistan.
Right, and then he had been, that was his third deployment or so?
That's right. That guy had PTSD incredibly bad, all kinds of issues going on. So that is not a case where we're asking for him to be pardoned, not at all. What we're asking for is that his sentence be reduced to 99 years and that he get proper mental health treatment. Because right. one of the things that's prompting this project is that the U.S. disciplinary barracks in Leavenworth does not provide adequate mental health treatment for guys with PTSD. Matter of fact, they cut it out completely. So these guys get no kind of services whatsoever. So that's really one of the big points for Bales, is to make sure he gets proper counseling.
And so this ties back into the Bergdahl case because his attorneys just filed a request for a pardon. Is that right?
That's what I understand, yes. I have not talked with Gene Fidel on that, and he's more than capable of doing that himself. And, you know, we're also not aligned with Bo Bergdahl. I mean, Mark Bowles doing the story, I think he's got a pretty good understanding of Bo Bergdahl, but he's not an advocate for Bergdahl.
And, right, you're just a First Amendment advocate in that sense.
That's right.
That we should be able to collect this information and distribute it in news channels, then that's a higher purpose than the particular case of the Bergdahl case.
That's right. And Mark Bowles is not in any way trying to stop the court-martial. That's not part of the case at all. It's just stopping the government from overstepping their bounds and trying to grab this stuff from Bergdahl. For example, there's a current policy within DOJ that, well, let me back up. The president believed that there were a lot of reporters getting subpoenaed way too much. So he turns to his attorney general and says, I want a new policy that doesn't prohibit subpoenaing reporters, but we got to respect the reporter's privilege. So Eric Holder develops a policy and issues it on new guidelines for how we're going to deal with reporters if we need information from them.
Oh, right. Part of the Attorney General's handbook that gives guidance to the AUSAs and USAs, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Now, we have brought this up saying you're not even following the president's guidelines that the Attorney General set forth. And the response has been, well, we're DOD, we're not DOJ, we don't have to follow it.
That's not binding on us. But
which I understand that, but it seems a little odd when the commander-in-chief is the one saying, this is the policy I want. He turns to his law enforcement guy to put it in place. But because no one specifically said, hey, DOD, this applies to you, that they can stand there and say, we don't have to follow it. I think it's kind of disingenuous.
Right, because in the end, it is the federal government saying this is our policy when it comes to subpoenaing reporters. It should be uniform,
right.
Not like ATF can do it. But I understand what you're saying.
That's right. And that's our big argument all along is you need to at least follow the guidelines. Because what the Army has wanted to do on this from the start is contact Mark Ball and say, give us all 25 hours. Give it to us or we're going to subpoena you. And we've got a copy of the draft subpoena that they were going to send, which says we want all 25 hours of everything you've done. And Mark Ball just absolutely was not willing to do that. Again, he is not there protecting Bo Bergdahl or advocating for him or trying to do anything to say the court-martial shouldn't go on. But at the same time, he's made certain binding promises to Bo Bergdahl about, yes, there are things that I will not reveal. But even more important than that to Bergdahl is when he's doing this story, in order to get this information, he's talking to a lot of people. And if people think that lawyers can be subpoenaed at the drop of a hat and have to turn over everything, it's going to stop people from talking to reporters.
Right.
So, for example, if this policy was that the Army is advocating was present, we would never have a deep throat in the Watergate. And it's more than just Bo Bergdahl, information Bergdahl's providing that he's protecting. He's also protecting sources of information from this story that came from those Bergdahl interviews. And this action has already hurt Mark Ball in that there are people now unwilling to talk to Mark because of the subpoena, and they're afraid that if I talk to you, the government's going to become aware of it. So it's had a very chilling effect, not just on Mark Ball, but other journalists around the country, which is why when we filed this action, we've got, I forget how many different First Amendment and media groups out there. It's something like 43 of them have joined on and filed an amicus brief in support of what we're doing.
Well, if I put my prosecutor hat back on for a moment, and it happened in the Wooderich case and it's happening in the Bergdahl case, it doesn't seem like there's that much additional information that they need.
No. It's really a little bit ridiculous, and I think I can see you get caught up in a case and you think, oh, this could have some really good stuff in it. But look, if it's really good stuff, it's going to be on the air, first of all.
Right,
so you're going to hear it. And second of all, if you look at what happened with the Haditha cases and Staff Sergeant Wooderich, he gives an interview with 60 Minutes. They want the outtakes. Now, that one seems almost more justified than Bergdahl because at least with Wooderich, he didn't give any pretrial statements about the shooting and the activities. Somebody told him early on, hey, go talk to a lawyer first before you talk to NCIS. So there's not this whole wealth of information from Staff Sergeant Wooders as to what was going on at the time he ordered his guys in, when he's pulling the trigger, so going to his intent. So I can understand why the prosecutors want it. They think maybe there's more that goes to the actual elements of the offense that we need. So I can understand more of why they were trying to get the tapes. With Bergdahl, you don't have that. Because what happened with Bergdahl is Bergdahl talked to the investigators. He has spent hours talking. He's been debriefing with SEER people, with the personnel recovery, with doctors, with intel guys from all different alphabet agencies. I mean, and he's actually been very helpful in providing this information. And then with the actual with Major General Dahl, who did the investigation, he cooperated with him and sat down for several days and just talked with him. It produced an over 300-page statement of Bergdahl.
Yeah, I remember Bohl in one of the tapes saying, 300 pages? He's like, yeah, if you spend 72 hours talking almost nonstop, it's a lot of pages.
So unlike in Haditha, where the prosecutors think that there may be something really on there that can help them, that's relevant the case, they've got a 300-page written statement from Bergdahl. Bergdahl has opened himself to, I can't count how many number of people, or hundreds of hours, a 300-page statement. What the hell else are they looking for? So,
I mean, he lays out a number of elements of the crime in just the tapes that have aired on Serial.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I can't imagine there's one other clip where he says, oh, yes, and I did this all because Osama bin Laden was my best friend, you know, and we had been in constant contact.
Yes. Now, I'm also sure that the Army is not a big fan of the Serial podcast, because the Serial podcast kind of tells a different story. It tells the whole story. I was with probably the majority of the population on Bergdahl, thinking, "Oh, this guy is a traitor. We need to bind him up and shoot him." Well, not really, but you know, that was kind of my feeling. And a lot of that was based on that, you know, with Fox News, with Megyn Kelly, has that board of soldiers that served with and knew Bergdahl and what they were saying about him, and which ends up to be mostly a whole big pile of BS.
Yeah, or they just didn't have all the understanding, you know, I think for some
that's
of them,
right.
That, you know, if you're an E3, you don't understand everything that's going on.
Right. So now I think, especially Major General Dahl, when he put his 22-man investigative team together to investigate what happened with Bergdahl, and when they start looking into it, they start to see something completely different. Now, this doesn't mean that Bergdahl didn't do wrong. Bergdahl definitely did wrong. I don't think he should be charged with what he's charged with based on the facts, but it also doesn't mean that Bergdahl should get a pass.
Right.
So it's somewhere in between the kind of the ridiculous, we're treating him like almost like a traitor right now on one end, and then at the other end you have some people say, you know, almost like he's a hero, you should let him go. It sounds to me like it should fall in the middle of that. That's having reviewed all this stuff now.
Somewhere in the middle along the lines that, you know, we as the military knew about it previously when we washed him out of the Coast Guard.
That's right. That's right.
That should have been one indication that he wasn't going to make it.
Yeah, that's right. Section 8 from the Coast Guard.
Right.
Absolutely. They should have known. He was also, you know, he was an Army PFC. He was new to the Army, new to combat. He didn't know anything. And for anybody who served, you see this. I mean, you'll see. I remember in the Marine Corps, especially when I was in artillery, you'll hear the Lance Corporal out there who says, "Man, these guys don't know what they're doing. If I was in charge, this is what we'd do to win the war." You know, that kind of thing. And for example, I'll tell you this little story. When there was a colonel I served with, and he shared with me a letter, and it came from.
Yes, please. This is a great letter.
It was a letter that was written by a Marine who was stationed at the Rifle Company Windward in Guantanamo Bay. And they were stationed there in Gitmo. This was in the 80s, I think it was. And, you know, they just sit there and they look at their Cuban, you know,
Cuban
counterparts on the other
side.
The Cuban sentries and the mirrors and all that. So he writes this letter to the commandant of the Marine Corps where he volunteers that, "Sir, with all this stuff with Cuba, just let me and some of my guys go in there and we'll take out Castro. And we're not asking for anything special other than maybe a weekend back home before we go, but just tell us what to do and we'll take care of this whole international problem."
It took him a while, but he finally did it, I think, about 2 weeks ago.
yeah, only took 40 years. But.
Right, yeah, and just so, volunteering this and sending it to the commandant.
But it's funny looking at the letter. Now, the kid who wrote that letter was absolutely serious, you know? "Sir,
right.
Just give us the word, and we'll fix this whole problem." When, you know, obviously it's not a way to fix any problem. It's not a solution, and nobody's taking it seriously, but that's kind of the thing you're looking at when you're dealing with Bo Bergdahl. From his limited perspective when he was there, he thought the Army was fighting the war wrong. He thought we should be kicking down doors and killing bad guys. That's what that Bergdahl thought, instead of this, we'll just help people build up the country kind of thing. And then he thought his leadership was lacking. He thought the battalion commander and other leadership, they were terrible, and he wanted to inform somebody about what happened. So he takes matters into his own hands and leaves, and he's going to run to this forward operating base 20 miles away and demand to see the general there, and he's going to air out what's wrong with everything. Now, this is not something you, that you could hear a junior soldier or Marine saying, but rarely would they actually act on it. Like, the kid in Guantanamo didn't actually send an excursion to Cuba to go kill Castro.
Right.
Bergdahl did. And Bergdahl hatched his little plan, and he took off.
And just the idea, I mean, I've worked for generals, you know, been on their staffs, and that's even in CONUS, in the U.S., you don't just have E3s just walking, you know, sauntering into the general's office, yeah, giving their 2 cents on how things should be going. I mean, that's
yeah, right. And kind of to illustrate the naivety of Bergdahl in thinking this is, again, he was going to run this 20 miles to this forward operating base to demand to see the general. The joke's on him. There was no general at that spot.
Right.
So he would have run there and, you know, somebody would have said, who the hell are you and why are you here? And no, there's no general and we don't care, you know.
Right,
so,
right. And it's all turning out horribly for you. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. You know, and I think he makes a comment in the Serial podcast about thinking he was kind of Jason Bourne or something. That's how he was thinking. And, of course, he leaves about midnight, his post, sneaks out of the position, and he gets terribly lost in the hills and gets discovered the next morning. So he's only gone a couple hours and gets discovered and captured. And then, boy, has he paid a price for that, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for being on today. It's great to have your insights on this, and don't be surprised if we call back and ask for another interview about some other cases.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure.
They can follow you on your website, Twitter, anything else you've got going out there that the listeners should know about?
I do have one thing. There is a case of Colonel Mike Stallman. And Colonel Mike Stallman was a lawyer in the Marine Corps who died in 2008 from a gunshot wound to the head, which they called a suicide. And we have been looking at it for a number of years and trying to convince folks that this was not a suicide, that he was actually murdered. And I am very confident of that point now. So you're going to see some things about that coming up fairly soon. The major network is going to be running a story on it. So you may see something like that coming up in January.
Yeah, and I know I've talked to his widow in the past. So I'll make sure we get some information out about that.
All right.
Well, thank you very much. Enjoy your day.
All right. I appreciate it, Wyrick. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All righty.
First, thank you to you, the listeners. Without your support, there's no chance I could have gotten this far with this podcast. And when I say this far, we now have a sponsor. It's official. Blue Apron is a sponsor of Military Justice. There's a lot to be said about Blue Apron, about its affordability, the variety of foods, how easy it is to cook, the freshness of the ingredients. All of those things are true. I've been a Blue Apron customer for about at least 6 months now. And I will say one of the best parts of the Blue Apron experience is how honest and flexible the company is. They don't lock you into weekly meals when you don't want them. They have a very easy app that allows you to customize when you get your meals. And the meals are always of great quality. They're always fresh and easy to prepare. But I've really enjoyed the flexibility you have. So if I'm traveling for something work-related or for some reason I'm going to be out of town, it's really easy to put your account on pause. That being said, I can't thank you enough, can't thank Blue Apron enough. And if you would, go check out this week's menu and get your first 3 weeks of meals for free. That includes free shipping. Just go to blueapron.com/military. You will love how good it feels to create incredibly home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Go do it, please. That's blueapron.com/military. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And we're just overjoyed here at Military Justice that they're now sponsoring us. Thank you. Saved Rounds and Alibis. This is the portion of the show where we address any of the hanging chads or questions from you, the listener. First, I want to address a little bit of listener feedback I've gotten. they asked about why the show has veered from the coverage of the Bergdahl case. As you heard in this episode, we're definitely not leaving anything out of the Bergdahl case. That being said, that case is going to go on for at least another year, if not years. There just isn't enough material for a bi-weekly podcast solely dedicated to the Bergdahl case. That's why I've had to mix in some additional information, and I hope you find that valuable also. That being said, you're never going to be cheated on the Bergdahl case. In fact, the next episode will cover a number of Bergdahl issues. We've had the military judge in the case rule about the introduction of evidence that other soldiers were killed looking for Bo Bergdahl, and the introduction of injuries possibly suffered by other soldiers while they look for Bo Bergdahl. We'll also be discussing the pending unlawful command influence motion that will assuredly be coming as soon as President-elect Trump takes office. Many of you will recall that then candidate Trump made a number of disparaging remarks about Bo Bergdahl and what should happen to him. That being said, don't worry, you're going to get an analysis of all of the issues in the Bo Bergdahl case. We just need to cover some different ground every once in a while, because otherwise we would have not nearly enough subject matter for a bi-weekly podcast. I hope you enjoy some of the other areas I've been discussing in military justice, but I just want to reassure you, the listeners, that you will never be shorted on your Bo Bergdahl coverage. Thank you as always, and I hope you have a great holiday season and enjoyed this episode. Wyrick out.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.